Aye. Day and for the, because is this the last? It's a fire. Oh, okay. The last case on our docket for the week is Safari Club International et al. As the plaintiff appellant versus Scott De La Vega in his capacity as Secretary of Department of Interior. And the appellants, we've got the we've got Jessica
Alloway. Alloway, Jessica, thank you, Your Honor. Yeah.
Jessica Alloway and also Jeremy Clare. And for the appellees, we've got Kevin McArdle.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm sorry to interrupt, and also I don't know if I should say it now or later, but appellees will be splitting their time with Ms. Briggs on behalf of the interveners. We'll be taking 5 minutes.
Okay, also, but that's Ms. Briggs on behalf of the interveners. Okay, that was missing from my sheet, but we'll accept that. Why don't we proceed with the appellant's argument?
Thank you, Judge Gold, and may it please the court. My name is Jesse Alloway, and I am appearing on behalf of the state of Alaska. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal and also be splitting 5 minutes of the opening comment time with counsel for Safari Club International. The Kenai rule was unlawful for four fundamental reasons. First, Congress has clearly spoken on the issue of bear baiting. The state does not concede that the service ever had this authority, but to the extent it did, Congress revoked that authority in 2017 when it passed the joint resolution disapproving of the statewide refuges rule. Second, even prior to the enactment of the joint resolution, the service lacked the authority to regulate the methods and means of hunting. The service's authority stems from Congress, yes. When it enacted ANILCA, Congress granted the service the authority to conserve populations of brown bears by regulating where and when hunting may occur, but Congress expressly preserved the state's right to manage how hunting would occur. Third, the Kenai rule was arbitrary and capricious. Brown bears on the Kenai Peninsula already have access to baiting stations. There is no evidence in the record that baiting increases human-bear conflicts or results in food-conditioned bears. What's more, let's assume that the service is correct. Despite the Kenai rule, black bear baiting still occurs on the Kenai Refuge and the Kenai Peninsula in general, and brown bears still have access to these bait stations. So again, if we assume that the service is correct and that baiting creates food-conditioned bears, the federal agency has actually created a public safety concern by prohibiting hunters from taking the quote-unquote food-conditioned bears that already visit these already existing bait stations. And fourth, the service failed to comply with the procedural requirements of NEPA by failing to adequately explain its reliance on a categorical exclusion. Counsel for Safari Club International intends to address the NEPA arguments in his remarks, so my focus today will be on the first three points. And before moving on, I'd also like to note that the state agrees with and supports the arguments of Safari Club International made regarding the Skelak Wildlife Recreation Area. And the state is prepared to rest on its briefing on that issue, but if the court has any questions, I'm happy to answer them now.
Well, I have a question. Does your argument incorporate any deference to the agency's decision?
No, Your Honor, not with regard to the bear baiting provision. So the state recognizes that under Chevron, the court would give reasonable deference to an agency's interpretation of law, but not when Congress has clearly spoken on the issue. And the state's argument is that in 2017, Congress clearly spoke on the issue when it said, service, you can't ban brown bear baiting on the refuge. And then when you get to the state's arguments regarding NILCA and the methods and means of who has the discretion to manage the methods and means of hunting, the service's interpretation of its regulation, or ANILCA, is not reasonable, Your Honor. It goes no meaning to Section 1314A and all of the other compromises that Congress implemented through the enactment of ANILCA.
Well, it's not Chevron deference that I'm addressing. It's the deference to the expertise of the agency in administering the environmental laws. Our cases say that we're supposed to defer to their expertise in these technical matters.
Sure, Your Honor, but I don't think in this particular instance that there is any, that the service really used any expertise. So again, you have the bear baiting provision. Congress clearly spoke on that issue. So even assuming the service had authority to say, ban bear baiting because it believed that it was a necessary conservation concern, Congress said, no, you don't have that authority.
Counsel,
I'm
curious about your argument that a resolution can overcome an environmental impact statement or assessment. So what case says that Congress by resolution, because this resolution was not directed toward this particular action, was it?
No, Your Honor, it was
not. So you're saying by implication, this resolution could nullify a regulation?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what case do you have to support the proposition that a congressional resolution can nullify an agency's regulation?
2 points, Your Honor. The state relies on this court's recent decision in Center for Biological Diversity versus Bernhardt, where this court directly addressed what that joint resolution would mean. And I want to emphasize for the court that resolution has certain context to it, but this is actually a law enacted by Congress. It passed the House, it passed the Senate, and it was signed by the President of the United States. So it's a law. And then in Center for Biological Diversity, this court looked at how that law was implemented, and it was implemented through the procedural statute in the Congressional Review Act. In reviewing the Congressional Review Act, this court said that that joint resolution, which is a law, substantively amended ANILCA, the Improvement Act, as well as the National Wildlife Refuge Administration Act. So does that, I think that answers your question.
I hear you. You answered my question.
Okay. But I also want to, to go back and answer your question a little bit in more detail, or to point out the provisions of the Congressional Review Act that I'm relying on, Your Honor. And I think the court's question is, this also relates to it, is what does the court do with the fact that that joint resolution was enacted after the Kenai Rule, and Congress never disapproved of the Kenai Rule?
Correct.
So I think in that situation, you have to look at, well, does the court apply a new statute, a new law, to a pending case?
Well, and I think more specifically, it's whether or not the resolution, if it could negate the regulation, did so by implication.
Sure, Your Honor. Sure, Your Honor. So, and I think that the way that the court would look at this is by the framework that the Supreme Court set out in the Landgraf case. And so what you would first do is you look at congressional intent. And I don't think congressional intent was clear in this particular situation. The joint resolution doesn't express any intent on Congress's part as to what it wants this court to do with priorly enacted regulations.
Well, doesn't that cut against your argument? Because if the joint resolution intended to nullify the regulation, wouldn't it have said so explicitly?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, because that's simply not how the Congressional Review Act works. So if you look at Section 801G, and I think this directly answers your point, Section 801G of the Congressional Review Act says we can't give any meaning to the fact that Congress didn't disapprove of the Kenai Refuge Rule. That was a prior Congress. it doesn't disapprove of it, and that doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean that it agrees with the service's interpretation, and it doesn't mean that it disagrees with the service's interpretation. So the only other relevant provision of the Congressional Review Act is Section 801B, and that tells us two things. It says the statewide refuges rule is not going to take effect because Congress has disapproved of it through that enacted legislation, and then it says the service cannot reenact that rule or a substantially new rule. And really what that means and what this court held in Center for Biological Diversity was that was Congress saying this is a substantive amendment to ANILCA, the Improvement Act, and the National Wildlife Refuges Administration Act. So that's a substantive amendment to the law. And then the court's question is, well, what do we do with that substantive amendment now that we have a case where the state is saying the service acted outside of its authority? And that's where I think the Supreme Court's decision in Landgraf is instructive, because the Supreme Court says without that congressional intent saying we only meant this to apply to future regulations, you've applied the general rule. And the general rule is the court applies the law as it currently exists today.
Counsel.
Yes.
If I could interject a question, please.
Sure.
So I thought that the prior resolution just related to the refuge rule, that it doesn't by its terms say it would apply to any other rule relating to Alaska.
Correct. It doesn't by it. So, but you have to read it. That's my point, Your Honors. You have to read it in conjunction with what the Congressional Review Act says that resolution means, as well as what this court said about that resolution in Center for Biological Diversity versus Zinke. So Congress says we're disapproving of the statewide refuge rule. Service don't enact a substantially same rule again. What does that mean? That means, and I think the important
rule was a blanket exclusion of the baiting in all of Alaska. That's what the joint resolution prohibited.
Well, the statewide refuge rule did a number of things, Your Honor. It said that the state couldn't implement predator control. It said that the state couldn't implement a number of quote unquote highly effective forms of hunting. And the specific example, or one of the specific examples that the statewide refuge rule said in the state said was bear baiting. Brown bear baiting, the state, you cannot implement that on the refuge.
The point I was trying to make is that it's a much broader ban than the rule that's at issue here.
Sure, it is a broader ban, and I would concede that. But again, to give meaning to the Congressional Review Act, which says the service can't implement a substantially similar rule, you have to be able to look at what the individual parts of the statewide refuge rules. Because otherwise, if you go with the interpretation that you're suggesting, so the service can get around the implications in the Congressional Review Act by enacting these rules piecemeal, and it will say, well, we didn't do all of this together. It doesn't look like the statewide refuge rule, but we're going to act one regulation that says you can't do predator control. We're going to enact a different regulation says that you can't ban bear baiting. And then it can do that individual thing for each of the refuges in Alaska and accomplish the very same thing that it did through the statewide refuges rule. So you have to look at all of that together.
Counsel, yes. If I could interject here, please.
Yes.
I don't think that Judge Zips was suggesting an interpretation. She was just asking you a question.
Sure. I will concede that point, and maybe I made an assumption, but I still think that that's an important point when this court is looking at statewide refuge rule in conjunction with the Congressional Review Act.
Okay, yeah, thanks for your clarification. Now, I have a question also then. Are you contending that the Kenai rule is substantially similar to the refuge rule?
Yes. As far as the bear baiting provision is concerned, yes. It's the same thing. If you look at the statewide refuge rule, the service says we're going to ban bear baiting on all refuges in Alaska because it's a highly effective form of hunting. If you look at the Kenai rule, it says we're going to ban brown bear baiting on the Kenai refuge because it's a highly effective form of hunting. As far as the bear baiting provision, it's a substantially same rule. And I think what the last point I would like to make on this particular issue is, in the Center for Biological Diversity case, the state and the service actually agreed on this particular topic, Your Honors. If you look at their brief on page 12 of its answering brief, it argues to this court that, quote, together with the Congressional Review Act, the joint resolution limits and effectively amends Congress's prior delegations of authority to Interior concerning the management of national wildlife refuges, end quote. So in other words, it was the service's position in Center for Biological Diversity that it used to have the authority to ban brown bear baiting, but the joint resolution revoked that authority. So to the extent it ever existed, and again, the state's not conceding that point, it no longer exists as soon as Congress enacted that joint resolution in 2017.
Council, do you have any authority in a precedential case of the Supreme Court, or of our circuit or any other circuit, that says that when it comes to regulating what happens on federal lands, that a state's position can take primacy over the responsible federal agency's position?
I don't think I have a case for you that says exactly that, Your Honor. But I think, again, the service can only act to the extent it's been granted the authority by Congress. So the state's position is that it would have to defer to the agency if the agency had that authority, and this agency doesn't have that authority in this particular case. I do want to point out that the state recognizes the service does have some authority when it comes to regulating wildlife on the Kenai Refuge. Section 304 of ANILCA grants the authority to the service to conserve the population of the species. The state's argument is simply that in this particular case, that authority, that what's in the service's tool belt to do that, is not banning brown bear baiting. It's to actually close the refuge to all forms of hunting. But that would require a very high showing on the service's part. It would have to show a conservation concern, and the state's not conceding that that actually happened in this particular case.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. I see that I have eaten a lot of time, so I'm going to rest unless the court has any further questions and give my co-counsel from Safari Club some time. Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jeremy Clare for Appellant Safari Club International. As Ms. Alloway indicated, I will specifically address the NEPA claims. There is a threshold question for those claims, and that is, do NEPA procedures apply? Federal appellees assert that no NEPA analysis was required for the relevant changes made in the Kenai rule because they maintain the environmental status quo. But certainly the Fish and Wildlife Service thought that NEPA analysis was required, and they effectively said so in the Kenai rule at 81 Fed Reg 27033. The rule conceded that NEPA applied when it cited a categorical exclusion applicable to the hunting and trapping provisions of the rule, which included only the three provisions that Safari Club and the state challenged in the district court. The service was not discussing the application of a categorical exclusion for the entire rule, as federal appellees assert. Notwithstanding the service's concession that NEPA applies, the challenged provisions do not maintain the status quo, and NEPA procedures were required.
Counsel, your argument is a little bit confusing, because isn't categorical exclusion part of the NEPA framework, so that if NEPA applies and the categorical exclusion is properly applied, then the NECA requirements have been satisfied?
Well, Your Honor, you're hitting the nail on the head there, and what I'm saying is that Despite federal appellees' assertions, the Fish and Wildlife Service clearly thought that NEPA applies because they applied a categorical exclusion.
Exactly. Now, if the categorical exclusion was properly applied, then there is no NEPA violation, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. We do not agree that the categorical exclusion was properly applied, but that is a different question, and I will get to that now if you'd like. But for that question, the district court's holding regarding the firearm discharge restriction is instructive to this court's consideration. And as I mentioned, all three of the hunting and trapping provisions in the Kenai Rule were addressed together by the Fish and Wildlife Service, and the district court held that the service's explanation of the application of the categorical exclusion was insufficient, and that the rule was also entirely silent regarding whether extraordinary circumstances apply, which might exempt application of the categorical exclusion, like whether the rule would be highly controversial. And none of the parties appealed the district court's holding related to the firearm discharge restriction. And so because the service combined its discussion of the three restrictions in the rule, this court should apply the same reasoning to find that the service did
not.
But
the district court didn't. The district court did not apply that same analysis outside the consideration of the firearm regulation.
Yes, Your Honor. The district court found that NEPA did not apply at all to the other two provisions. And so that's why there is that threshold question for these two provisions as to whether NEPA applies at all, meaning whether the Fish and Wildlife Service even had to apply a categorical exclusion, or whether they could have been entirely silent on the matter. And so that's the threshold question. And in the district court, the judge cited to National Wildlife Federation v. ESPE and California v. BLM, but in ESPE, in both of those, the courts found that the actions challenged were maintaining the status quo. However, the challenge provisions here are actions that result in a different environmental outcome than would have otherwise occurred if the provisions were not adopted.
But so counsel, does it matter if the district court erroneously found that NEPA did not apply if we are reviewing this her decision de novo?
No, it doesn't ultimately matter, Your Honor. But federal appellees maintain that NEPA does not apply to these two provisions in their appellate briefing. So, and they do cite to those cases as well, which I think are distinguishable in the fact that again, the Fish and Wildlife Service, had they not adopted the two provisions, the environmental outcome would have been quite different on the ground. And the Fish and Wildlife Service recognized that they were enacting those provisions to prevent different outcomes within the refuge. For example, and if I know I'm way over time, so please just stop me if you want, but the brown bear provision, the state permitted the harvest of brown bears overbait because they wanted a more effective method to sustainably reduce the historically high bear population and to address increasing human bear conflicts. But by closing the refuge, the service effectively split the Kenai Peninsula into two different areas with differing management regimes, which could impact things like brown bear densities on and off the refuge, whether hunters choose to hunt brown bears on or off the refuge.
All right, counsel, you've answered more than answered my question. So I give the floor back to Judge Gould.
Yes, thank you. Well, I think we should proceed with the Department of Interior's position.
Good morning. I'm Kevin McCardle on behalf of the Department of the Interior, and may it please the court. As I mentioned earlier, appellees will be dividing their time, so Ms. Briggs will be taking 5 minutes of appellee's time. There's two central issues in the case. The first is whether the service's enactment of the challenge provisions of the Kenai Rule was within the scope of its authority under ANILCA. And the second is whether the service's decision triggered the requirements of NEPA. And with the court's permission, I'd like to address each of those issues in turn. On the authority question, despite the extensive amount of briefing, it really only comes down to one question. Did the service act within the scope of its delegated property clause authority under ANILCA? Because you heard today from Ms. Alloway, and it's also clear from Alaska's reply brief, that everyone agrees Congress delegated at least some of its property clause authority to the service when it directed the service and the service alone to manage the refuge. Everyone also agrees that if the service is acting pursuant to that authority, its action preempts any conflicting state laws. So the only question for the court really needs to answer is whether, in fact, the service was acting within the scope of its authority under ANILCA. And there's no question that it was. The earlier discussion focused on the brown bear baiting restriction. So unless the court would like me to address the SCLAC restrictions, I'll focus on that one as well. The service maintained the longstanding brown bear baiting prohibition in the refuge to conserve the brown bear population. That's documented in detail at SCR 184 through 185. There's no question that that was a permissible exercise of the service's delegated property clause authority under ANILCA, because Section 303 mandates that the service, as the top priority objective, conserve fish and wildlife populations in the refuge without also requiring conformity to state law. And it says down low at subsection 5 that the service shall also allow fish and wildlife recreation, including hunting, only to the extent it's consistent with the highest priority conservation mandate. So the service had the requisite authority. Now, the plaintiffs offer three contrary legal arguments, but none of them has merit. The first one is the plaintiffs point to a parenthetical contained in the service's general regulations that says bear baiting is prohibited, and then in a parenthetical it says, but it's allowed in Alaska in accordance with state law. And they say that that's sort of a binding mandate on the service. It can never do anything to prohibit baiting, no matter what the consequences. And that's not true. And the basic reason, the most basic, is because it ignores the Alaska specific regulations. It's true as a general matter, not just with respect to baiting, but to hunting generally, that hunting is authorized in accordance with state law. But under Section 36.31 of the regulations, hunting and every other recreational activity is subject to the state's, to the service's closure authority in Section 36.42, which the service properly invoked here. That section, it's important, it says the service can restrict an activity otherwise allowed. So it contemplates a situation like this where, you know, you might have hunting under state law that's allowed, but the service nevertheless has to enclose it, has to invoke its closure authority for resource protection or some other valid management consideration. Now, Alaska argues, Alaska acknowledges that the service has this authority, but it says it service only has two options. It can close the whole refuge to all brown bear hunting, or it can impose seasonal restrictions, and that's it. That's not only not true, it would result in an unnecessary intrusion onto the state's management authority. The regulations in 36.31 and also in 36.42 state that the service can restrict an activity or close an area. They don't impose any additional restrictions. And if you accepted Alaska's position, it would mean that even when a less severe restriction could accomplish the conservation, could ensure consistency with the conservation mandate, the service would have no option but to just close the whole refuge entirely to brown bear hunting. That doesn't make any sense, and it would result in unnecessary intrusions on state authority.
Counsel,
also, it's not.
Do you agree with opposing counsel's position that deference has no place in our analysis of this regulation?
No, not in the least. Certainly, and I think Your Honor was referring before to deference to the service's factual findings. And certainly with respect to the service's conclusion that brown bear baiting in the refuge would lead to conservation concerns, that's absolutely entitled to deference. There are detailed factual findings laid out in the rule, and you know they fall squarely within the service's area of expertise, and they're entitled to the traditional deference under the APA. And I don't think Alaska, at least, is really challenging that, because they barely address the service's conservation justification, and really focus on, you know, these legal arguments as to why the service supposedly doesn't have authority to restrict brown bear baiting. And their last argument is this argument about the Congressional Review Act, where they say that Congress's disapproval of the refuges rule actually substantively amended ANILCA to bar the service from prohibiting brown bear baiting. And the simple answer there is that that argument is foreclosed by the CRA itself, because the CRA tells us exactly what the consequences of a joint resolution of disapproval is, and that's in Section 801 A and 801B. It says the disapproved rule doesn't take effect, and the service cannot reissue the substantively the same rule. Now, Alaska knows there's a problem there, so it changed the statutory language in its presentation to say, well, it prohibits the service from implementing a substantially similar rule. That's not what it says. It's forward-looking statute. It says it prohibits the service from reissuing the same rule in the future. And since this case involves a pre-existing rule that predated the refuges rule, the entire discussion of the CRA is irrelevant. And also, there's nothing in the joint resolution itself that supports Alaska's position, because that terse resolution just says the refuges rule is disapproved. And there's nothing in our brief filed in the other case, and I would encourage the court to take a look at it. In no way did we say that, well, the statute, the joint resolution deprived the service of its authority to bar certain hunting methods or to enforce the conservation mandate. What we said there is what the same thing that this court said in CBD v. Bernhardt, which is if there was a substantive amendment, it was to bar the service from reissuing the same rule. That's it, consistent with the CRA. So that entire line of argument just has no relevance to this case at all. And there's no question that the service has delegated property clause authority to restrict brown bear baiting. And just on that point before I move on, the notion that the service's authority is cabined to simply closing the whole refuge to brown bear baiting is also inconsistent with ANILCA section 304B, which says that service can only allow a use on the refuge, which includes hunting, to the extent it's compatible with the major purposes of the refuge, which obviously include the primary conservation purpose. And then it grants the service broad authority to issue regulations or terms and conditions as necessary and appropriate to ensure that activities remain consistent. That's a broad delegation of rulemaking authority, and this rule fell squarely within the scope of that authority. And finally, on the NEPA argument, the service's decision to enact the challenge provisions of the rule didn't trigger the requirements of NEPA because it maintained the environmental status quo in the refuge and didn't change the level of human intervention. And I think the basic defect with the plaintiff's argument here is that Alaska changed course. Alaska changed its management objectives. Alaska wanted more bears harvested. Alaska tried to open the refuge to more hunting. The service didn't change course. The service maintained the status quo in the refuge under the existing plans. The service does NEPA when it creates a plan. It did NEPA in 2007 when it did a management plan for Skilak. Nobody challenged that plan, and that plan resulted in the hunting restrictions that are in effect today. The service did a comprehensive EIS again in 2010 when it issued the current refuge management plan. Alaska participated in that plan. That plan ratified the Skilak management plan with the existing restrictions, and they didn't challenge that plan. But then 3 years later, Alaska says, well, now we want more hunting. So we're gonna pass a regulation over the service's objections, opening up the area to these hunting. That doesn't impose NEPA obligations on the federal government. The federal government did nothing more than step in and say, we're keeping things as they are under the current plans that were the subject of NEPA. And that decision changed nothing. It didn't change anything inside the refuge, and it didn't change anything outside of it. The level of human intervention is exactly the same. So under this court's decisions in Kootenai and Espy, it didn't trigger the requirements of NEPA. And so for those reasons and the additional reasons stated in our brief, the district court's decision should be affirmed. Unless the court has any questions, I'll turn the remainder of my time over to Ms. Briggs.
But I have a question. Is it the agency's position that NEPA does not apply, or that the requirements of NEPA were met through application of the categorical exclusion? What's your position?
It's both in the alternative. These two provisions did not trigger the requirements of NEPA because they maintain the status quo and didn't change the level of human intervention in the refuge or outside of it at all.
Isn't that the definition of categorical exclusion, which is kind of a NEPA satisfaction of NEPA, even though you don't have to go through all of the studies? I'm confused as to why you would make the argument that NEPA does not apply.
Sure, Your Honor, it's a good question. Let me see if I can clarify it. because a CE is a form of NEPA compliance, it's a different argument to say that it's covered by a CE. So, you know, our initial position is that the challenge provisions of the rule don't trigger NEPA at all. But even if they did, we did a CE, these two provisions clearly maintain essentially the same level of permitted use, which is what the CE covers. So they clearly fell under the CE. But legally, there are two distinct arguments. One is NEPA doesn't apply at all. And then two is, even if it does, we did a sufficient NEPA analysis in the form of the CE, which is a form of NEPA compliance.
Right, but I don't understand, I just don't get the argument of why NEPA would not apply at all. I don't understand why you would make that argument. And what's the basis for that? Is there a case that says in this situation that NEPA does not apply?
Yes, we think that there are. The Kootenai case cited in our brief and the SB case.
Okay.
Now, the Kootenai case came out the other way, and it said that NEPA did apply. But the principle that it announced is that NEPA applies whenever there's a change in the level of human intervention, whenever the federal action, that's critical here too, the federal action causes the change.
Well, but I ask you, do you have a case that says NEPA does not apply? You're pointing me to one where it says NEPA does apply. Do you have a case that says NEPA does not apply?
Yes. Well, in the Kootenai case, the ultimate holding was that NEPA applied, but
my question is, can you cite me to a case where the holding was that NEPA did not apply?
Yes, Your Honor, I apologize. It's the SB case would be an example. So there, ownership of property or a property interest was transferred from the federal government to a private entity. And the plaintiffs argued, well, that triggers the requirements of NEPA. And the court said, no, it doesn't, because even though the entity that owns the property changed, the nature of the use on the ground did not, because the property was used for grazing and that remained exactly the same. So that is the Ninth Circuit case that I would point to, Your Honor. And I would just say, I totally understand your point, but in Kootenai, there was a principle announced.
I understand your argument, but I was asking you a specific question that Kootenai does not answer.
Okay, sorry, Your Honor. SB would be it then. So unless any additional questions from the court?
None from me.
No.
Judge Zips?
No, thank you.
No, hearing none, I think it's time to hear from Ms. Briggs.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, and good morning, or good afternoon, I suppose, in San Francisco. Rachel Briggs for the Alaska Wildlife Alliance. I'd like to address some points regarding the Congressional Review Act today, and then some points regarding the agency's authority under ANILCA and the Improvement Act. Contrary to the state's assertions here, Congress's action under the Congressional Review Act did not rewrite ANILCA or the Improvement Act to preclude the agency from regulating brown bear baiting. Rather, as this court held in Center for Biological Diversity v. Bernhardt, the impact of that amendment was simply to deprive the refuges rule of any force and effect and obligate the service to execute the joint resolution. In other words, to strike the refuges rule. The text of the Congressional Review Act itself is quite clear that it's a narrow statute. The effect of an action is simply to strike the rule at issue and preclude the agency from reissuing or issuing a new rule that's substantially the same. So for this court to reach back into the text of other statutes and reinterpret the text is beyond the invitation of the Congressional Review Act. Regarding the agency's authority, the state cites to Section 1314A to argue that it has been preserved authority over methods and means of hunting. However, this is not what the text of ANILCA says. Section 1314A preserves the state's existing authority over wildlife. And as the state itself concedes in its reply brief, under Metlakatla Indian Community v. Egan, the state's authority granted at statehood over wildlife is exactly the same as that of every other state. In other words, state regulations may apply on federal lands until and unless they are preempted by the federal agency. This is clarified by Section 1314B, which directs federal agencies to manage federal lands like the refuge in accordance with ANILCA, and then Section 1314C, which directs the agencies to manage in accordance with both state and federal law. Under federal law, under ANILCA, the agency is directed to protect a natural diversity of animals, including bears and wolves. And under the Improvement Act, it must protect biological integrity, diversity, and environmental health. These directives encompass necessarily the ability to regulate hunting on the refuge. The state also suggests that the agency is limited to only limiting hunting for purposes of conservation. However, this is contrary to the language of ANILCA, the Improvement Act, and the agency's regulations, which also allow it to take action for purposes of public health or administration authority, which is quite broad. Finally, the state rests heavily on a distinction between methods and means of hunting on the one hand and closures to hunting on the other, in distinguishing between its authority and the services. However, that distinction is not reflected in regulation or statutory text. The provision of regulation at issue here, 50 CFR 36.42, as counsel for the service noted, specifies that the service can restrict an activity. That would include an activity such as brown bear baiting on the refuge. The only other authority that the state cites to for this distinction between methods and means and closures is Section 1313 of ANILCA, which relates to the National Park Service's authority, not the Fish and Wildlife Service's authority. Moreover, that section does not limit the Park Service to only closing areas to hunting. It also allows the Park Service to manage hunting in accordance with federal law and regulation. Again, that necessarily includes the ability to take the lesser action of restricting a particular activity rather than closing the entire area to hunting. For those reasons, we would ask this court to uphold the Kenai rule and the district court's opinion. Are there other questions I can answer for the court?
No, but I have a question for Mr. Mercado. You cited me to the National Wildlife Federation versus SB case. I have it up now. I want you to direct me to the language that says NEPA does not apply.
If you'll give me a minute, Your Honor, I'll try to pull that up.
If you were talking about page 1343, it says where a proposed federal action would not change the status quo, and EIS is not necessary. It does not say that NEPA does not apply.
You're correct, Your Honor. And I interpreted that to mean that NEPA would not apply because the claim in the case was for that an EIS was required.
That's different than saying NEPA does not apply. It says under NEPA, no environmental impact statement is required. So that's a totally different concept than saying NEPA does not apply at all.
Okay, fair enough, Your Honor. But I would say, now this is not the holding in Kootenai, but that case, if I'm remembering correctly, and now you have me doubting myself, but I think the court said that NEPA does not apply where the federal action doesn't change the level of human intervention. And in that case, there was a reduction in the level of human intervention, so NEPA did apply. But here, there's no change whatsoever. So that was our interpretation of the cases and the district courts. And well, I apologize.
I'm questioning your interpretation now too, but I'll look at Kootenai and see if it says that.
I apologize, Your Honor, if I wasn't clear about that. That was my understanding of both of those cases.
Great. Okay, well, I think Ms. Alloway reserved some time.
Well, before we leave, I'll just say Kootenai says the same thing that the SBK says, that no environmental impact statement is required if there is no change in the status quo.
Okay. Thank you, Judge Gould. I do think we used our time, but if you would allow me a couple of minutes, I'd really appreciate it.
Okay, we'll give you 2 minutes.
Okay, thank you. I think the parties have exhausted the Congressional Review Act argument, but I do want to make one point that I think illustrates the problems with the service's position. Let's assume that the court agrees with the appellants and says NEPA does apply and the service didn't properly explain its application of a categorical exclusion, and it remands the rule back to the agency. I think the Congressional Review Act says the service can't reissue that rule because it's substantially the same as the statewide refuges rule. That bear baiting provision is substantially the same. And I think that illustrates really the heart of the state's position and why it believes this was a substantive amendment to ANILCA and revoke some of the service's authority. I'd also like to address the service's position that there's no question it has this authority via the property clause. There's definitely a question about that, and the state raised this in its briefs. If you look at both of the Supreme Court's recent decisions in Sturgeon, ANILCA was a series of compromises. Yes, on one hand, it's reserving a bunch of federal land and it's granting the service the authority to maintain that land in the populations of the species and its natural diversity. But on the other hand, the Congress set up what the Supreme Court said was an often conflicting goal of preserving the state's local ability to manage local decisions, the hunting methods and means of hunting. So the state's encourages the court to rely or look at Section 1314. It sets up basically a division of labor. Section A says the state has the authority to manage methods and means of hunting or manage fish and wildlife, which admittedly the state interprets as the methods and means of hunting. Section B says that the service has the authority to regulate public lands. And then Section 3 says to take fish or wildlife on public lands, you have to comply with state law, the methods and means of hunting, and federal law, the service's regulations pertaining to those public lands. Section C is not an additional grant of authority. It's simply a recognition of the division of labor. So with that, Your Honor, I thank you for the extra time.
Yes, you're welcome. Well, I just want to thank all the advocates. We've had 4 excellent presentations, and all of the advocates gave us a great deal of help in dealing with the difficult and intricate issues in a case such as this. You know, the case has high stakes for the people, the rural impacts, and also for other species who are present in Alaska. So we will now submit the Safari Club International case, and the parties will hear from the panel in due course. And that concludes our arguments for today, and with our thanks to all the advocates, we'll conclude for the day and adjourn.